This is episode number 797 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to hear Matt's New York Comic Con recap. We'll talk about the Milestone Universe returning, a new Pumpkinhead comic, and a new Neil Gaiman comic. Our comics this week will be Eugenic number 1, Marvel Legacy number 1, and Amazing Spider-Man number 32. And our BoobTube and Big Screen Bonanza comes back this week with the season premieres of The Flash and Riverdale.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
God clean the whole fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the just returned from New York, Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Good, and I was wondering if you were going to say the bearded and the thinner.
Oh, the bearded and the thinner. The beard is looking good.
I trimmed it up a little bit. I'm kind of liking the
for
way
those
it goes.
That, I mean, we'll, you know what? We'll plug VikingOilsLLC.com right now.
Yep.
Because your beard, I dare say, is more robust than I've seen it in a long time. Like, people know that you can get away with the goatee. We've talked about this ad nauseum on the show, but you're not a big beard guy.
Yep.
You're more of a goatee guy. The goatee comes in nicely. The beard, kind of patchy over the years, but it looks like to me, and maybe it's just the shadowing and the light here in the basement.
Yeah.
It looks like it's starting to come in completely.
I did not spend one day without my little canister of Viking Oil's beard balm. I mean, I had it everywhere because as it's starting to grow out, that's where I think it's getting a little better because I do have the patchy spots. But when you put the beard balm in, you can put it on and it's like hair mousse. You just slick it back and it looks like it fills in everything. So very
well, whatever
happy
with it's it. Doing, you're looking pretty slick over there.
And
pretty good. But the thinner, I want to hear about that. What's the thinner
all right,
thing?
So I have been now, as we're recording this, I've been 2 weeks and one day of having Isagenix shakes for breakfast and lunch, having some snack, you know, like the
they're not a sponsor yet, but they could be after
oh,
the
they
show.
Might be.
Go ahead, please,
they
continue.
Might be. And then having like snack bars from Isagenix, not just like Snickers.
Sure.
And then I will have a sensible as can be dinner.
Sure.
Or one meal is going to be sensible. And then I will have a soda with that. So I have gone from 5 sodas a day, 4 sodas a day to 1 soda a day.
Whoa.
For 15 days. I've had my withdrawals. I'm kind of going through the emotional part of this right now because it's kind of
tough.
It's
like breaking up with a, you know,
with
like
a lover.
High school sweetheart. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely.
With my lover since third grade.
Right.
And
yours high school sweetheart, it just happens to be soda.
Yes. And green and liquid.
Right.
So I went, I started this thing at about 218, 219.
Okay.
And at last weigh, 205.
Nice, dude.
205.
Which really means that within another week or two, you'll be under 200.
Yeah. And I mean, my sports playing weight is 185, 195. Somewhere in there is where
sure.
I want to be. And that's obvious. That's easily attainable now.
Yeah. So that's also my fighting weight. And this is very motivational for me because I have also recently been trying to get rid of some of the extra pounds and have been adjusting like when I eat and how I eat and stuff like that. And that's always my barometer is getting under 200.
Yeah.
Even if I'm at 199, 198, like that barrier of 200 was really big for me because I was above it for so long. That when I finally got below it. So that's awesome, man. Congratulations
yeah, thank
to you.
You.
And it must have been difficult to maintain that over the weekend of New York Comic Con, which is my way of segueing into our story.
Perfect segue. And it was a little difficult, but I brought a little blender with me, so I was able to make shakes while
you.
I was there.
That's how you know you're dedicated.
Yeah. And when we went out to get dollar pizza slices on So Thursday night, obviously, I'll start with the menu part.
Sure.
Obviously, Wednesday night, Rice King. Had
absolutely.
To do the Rice King.
You knew that was happening.
Thursday night was, what did we get? We got pizza from someplace in Norwalk. And then Friday night was dollar pizza slices. I treated the boys, and I had 6.
I like how you pick your spots.
Yes. Yeah. Dudes, this one's on me. So I ended up having 6 slices, which might have been a little overboard, but I had one soda with them.
But you
too,
said
which was
a
great.
Sensible dinner, and if you look at it from the financial sense, it was very sensible because
yes.
it was very inexpensive. So and, I think that that counts.
And it's a cut down of four slices that I would have had on top of the other six.
Exactly.
I had.
Yeah.
And then Saturday night we went to Panda East. Or no,
okay.
Panda Express in New York, right from our right near our hotel room. We stayed in the west side, east side. Very expensive, so we had to find the cheap places to eat. But talking about New York Comic Con. People have been all over, especially at Amazon when I went back to work.
I will tell you the extent of what I saw, and I pulled a couple news tidbits from like panels and stuff like that that we can talk about in a minute. But all I saw from afar was 200,000 people over the course of the weekend.
And they were all there on Friday, and they were all there on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
Saturday, you could move around. It was really odd.
Which is insane, right? Because
yeah, that's the odd part. Now, Artist Alley used to be in a – if you know the Javits Center, you walk in, you take a right, and you go all the way to this huge room, which is about the size of six football
fields.
It's
like a huge airport hangar almost.
They have now started renovations there, and that's the area that they're starting. That was off limits. That wasn't being used.
Oh.
So they were now downstairs in a much smaller area.
Which is where they've traditionally done panels.
That was part of – I believe that's where they used to do some of the panels.
Yeah, and they also used to do big celebrity signings
yeah,
down
but
there.
But this was insane down there. I only went down a few times. I had to bring Andrew Edge, and Andrew did a Zach Wilde print for Greg Capullo.
Nice.
So I had to give Greg a book. So we go down there. Took me 15, 20 minutes just to fight through the crowd to get down there. We see him. His wife Jackie saw us and waved us over. So we got in, got the stuff. Andrew got a great picture of him and Zach Greg with the Zach print, or not the print, the actual picture of it. And Greg was ecstatic. Greg is a huge Black Label Society fan, so got really excited about that one. But when I have to tell people about what was your New York Comic Con experience, basically it's sitting at my table
yep.
for 10 hours a day for 4 days. And I had a ton of fun, though. I met a lot of people. Very interesting that there were dollar comics that went to 50-cent comics very quickly by the bathrooms. So every time I came back from the bathroom, I came back with a stack of comics.
It's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, so I did a lot of good shopping. Met Peter Capaldi, was able to give him a book.
I saw the picture.
Took a picture. We had to take about five.
Did you put that up in the Secret Identity Facebook group yet?
Not yet. I will put that
one
up.
Yeah, put that one up.
So one of the interesting things was when you go to these photo shoots, and I don't normally do the photo shoots.
Right.
But there was no way I was going to get to Peter Capaldi because all the people that I knew that got me to Matt Smith are no longer with Reed
yep.
or the photo company. So I paid my thing. It was $100 to do it. I figured I might as well. And when you get down there, usually it's, hey, here you are. Hi, nice to meet you. Here's your picture. See you later.
Yeah.
And when I got out there to get my picture, the guy who was doing the photo said, hey, the gloss on the cover of your book blocked the book. Do you want a retake? I'm like, okay. So he took me back in, took another shot.
Nice.
Came back out. There's a gloss on this one too. And I had Vin Fronte and Hunter McFalls from Witch Hunter with me waiting. And it was so funny because they're like, how many more shots are you going to do? We ended up taking five shots.
Uh-huh.
Finally, the photographer said, okay, Peter, lower the book, lower the book, lower the book. I had to lower the book because then she came in, grabbed it. She positioned it perfectly because his angle was more blurry or more glossy. And so five shots later, we finally got the picture.
And how was Peter Capaldi?
Really cool guy.
Yeah.
Every time I kept coming back, he looked at me and kind of laughed and went, we're spending a lot of time together, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I said, yep. So the other interesting one, I was looking over and three booths down from us was Tor Publishing.
Okay.
And I saw a guy in a red sports coat that looked a lot like Bruce Campbell. So as I started to walk a little closer, I saw that it was Bruce Campbell.
Which makes perfect sense because his sequel to Confessions of a B-Movie Actor just came out.
Yes, and I picked that up there. So if you bought the book, you could get it signed and meet him and say hi. And it was very quick. This was another sort of cattle call thing. But I went in, and the funniest thing is I've got to post the pictures up on Facebook because I haven't yet. Bruce was in complete character, and he had the red smoking jacket
on. As he usually is.
And a freaking amazing guy. I gave him a copy of Monkey See, See Monkey and said, you know, when I was writing the main character, which is me, I said, there's a lot of Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi kind of story in that.
Yeah.
And as I handed him the book, he made a face and went, really, me? But the face he made as my friend took the picture looks like he's talking to me and making a face at me.
Yep.
Then the next picture he took when I said, I'd like to give you this book. And he's like, you're giving me a book. And he made another cranky looking face as he has the book in his hands looking at it. So I've got these photos that are pretty funny that I have to do a lot of explaining.
That's awesome.
I saw Mike Pellerito, our buddy from Archie.
That was going to be my question for you is, did you run into Mike Pellerito?
Yep,
because obviously we're going to talk about the Riverdale premiere in a little while.
Yeah, so Archie was three booths away. He came over to us, said hi. Then on Kids Day, which was Sunday, he brought his three kids over. So they hung out and just a bunch of – a great family, a lot of fun, a lot of action going on at the Archie booth. And one of the cool cosplays –
Well, they just announced Alex – Segura as co-president at Archie.
So there is a lot of movement. That was one of the things that I saw, that right now you've got a lot of co-presidents.
Yep.
So things like that have been moving around a little bit. Saw Alex. Alex said hi. But the cool thing about a lot of the cosplay that I saw at the show, very Riverdale themed. I probably saw 25 Archies and Veronicas,
yep,
which was great. I saw several families that were all dressed up. But the coolest thing was seeing a lot of young girls dressed as Riverdale Vixen cheerleaders.
Yep.
So that was super cool to see. And a lot of fun. Every year, I like 2 days afterwards, I'm like, not going back there. It's just insane. Just crazy. Never go back. But it's a lot of fun. I always end up finding my way back and got to get you back into it, hopefully with changes in schedules.
I know, right?
That'll be happening.
I did pull a few of the news stories because I know that when you're sitting at your table all weekend, actually getting any of the news is like, it's not happening. Like, it's easier to follow what's going on at New York Comic Con when you're not at New York Comic Con.
Yes.
So DC Comics and Milestone Media revealed the first titles in their revived partnership. They are bringing back the Milestone universe. Mm-hmm. The characters of the Milestone's Dakota universe are finally returning in a new collaboration called Earth-M, which will launch in spring 2018. The initiative will see the return of classic characters as well as new creations. Things will kick off with Milestone, a series from Reginald Hudlin and artist Ken Lashley. The series will lay the foundation for the Earth-M initiative, focusing on Icon and Rocket, as well as the other 90s-era Dakota Universe characters. Hudlin will also write Static Shock, an ongoing about the popular teenage superhero with electrical powers that will be drawn by Kyle Baker.
Very, very,
very
cool.
Very excited for that.
Wow.
Hudlin is also writing Love Army, a miniseries about a secret army of women sworn to protect the planet Earth-M, a series with Alice Randall about a new vigilante character. Finally, Greg Pak will tell the twisted story of a couple that shares one body for eternity in the miniseries Duo.
That sounds interesting.
Milestone was founded in 1993 by Dennis Cowan, Michael Davis, Derek Dingle, and Dwayne McDuffie to improve the representation of minority characters and creators and characters in comics. Milestone comics were distributed by DC, which gave the creators wide leeway and let them retain the rights to their creations. In part due to its adaptation as an animated show, Static Shock is the most well-known of the imprint's characters, which also include Icon and Hardware. So that's huge news.
It is really big news. I know people were talking a lot about it while we were there, and that was – I remember when the Milestone universe hit – I remember picking those up at the newsstand. If you remember the newsstand,
yep,
that chain of great bookstores, I picked up almost every book there because my comic store wasn't carrying them at the time, but I could go to the newsstand and get them. And I thought it was a great – wasn't even looking at it at the political side or the cultural side of it. I really just enjoyed the stories from a completely different point of view. So it's great to have that back. I will definitely be looking into that one.
There you go. In horror-related news – Dynamite Entertainment announced the creator behind their new Pumpkinhead series, which I didn't even know was happening.
Saw the poster.
Lance Henriksen, obviously Pumpkinhead, awesome. Horror maestro Cullen Bunn,
mm-hmm,
who seems to be writing...
He's writing everything maestro.
Everything for
Cullen
everyone,
Bunn.
Right? I mean, talk about not putting your eggs in one basket.
Yep.
This guy doesn't have enough eggs.
And he's doing a great job on all the things that he writes.
He is like – we make this joke all the time, but like there was a few years ago where it was like Charles Sewell's name was on everything.
Yep.
That's Cullen Bunn now.
Mm-hmm.
Literally everything. Cullen Bunn will be writing Pumpkinhead, which is based on MGM's landmark 1980s horror film franchise about a monstrous demon that seeks out revenge on teenagers in rural Appalachia. Dynamite has yet to announce the artist or further plot details on the series, which will debut in February. Kelly Jones is one of the cover artists. So that's huge news. I am very happy to see Pumpkinhead come back. That's a series that I feel like never really got as much attention as it deserved. I have a Pumpkinhead t-shirt at home. Like that is that first movie especially is a really great one. So
and you know, that character is like, the movies have kind of gone by the wayside and people don't necessarily give it the credit that it's due. Visually, I think that is one of the most imposing, scary characters that came out, because I jumped when I saw Dynamite Booth was like two booths away from us, and I walked around the corner and saw a big pumpkin head staring at me, and my first thought was, yikes.
Great character design, and I wonder if that's a Stan Winston. I think that it is. I'd have to look it up, but absolutely, great character design. And also from Dark Horse Comics, and I'm really excited about this because I didn't even know this story existed. Dark Horse Comics has announced their latest Neil Gaiman adaptation, Gaiman's Hugo and Locus award-winning short story, A Study in Emerald, is being adapted by Eisner winner Raphael Albuquerque and Raphael Scavone, with colors by Dave Stewart. The 80-page hardcover will be in stores on June 20th. Now, you might ask yourself, Matthew, what's A Study in Emerald?
I am asking that.
Well, let me answer that for you. A Study in Emerald brings together the mythoses created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and H.P. Lovecraft.
Two of the bigger names ever.
Which I was like, whoa, what?
I never knew that they were connected.
A brilliant detective and his partner attempt to solve a horrific murder in the Whitechapel slums. They soon find themselves at the palace, where the Great Old One, in the guise of the Queen, consults with them about the case. The award-winning tale appears in Gaiman's short story collection, Fragile Things and New Cthulhu, The Recent Weird, an anthology edited by Paula Garan. The story has also inspired a board game. How in the world did I not know that this existed? I was blown away. So I am absolutely getting this. That is awesome. I need to track down the story and enjoy it, because I can't believe that I didn't know that it existed.
And we are in your time of year too. This is your Christmas month.
Not only is this my time of year, as we record today, I have a novella that is releasing tomorrow, both on Amazon.com and on DriveThru Comics. It is the sequel to the first book that I wrote, According to King in Yellow. This book is called Chasing the King in Yellow, and that is coming out tomorrow. So yes, it is absolutely my time of year. Jolene and I are working on edits for Haunted, which is the second book in our Woodsby Murder series, and lots of great stuff going on. If you're a horror fan, go to MidnightSocietyTales.com. That is the writers group that I'm in, and we do a blog for that Jolene started, where we have lots of cool things going on for fall, including we are doing a book club for the new book from Stephen and Owen King called Sleeping Beauties, which I'm sure was all over New York Comic Con.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Now that makes complete sense.
Yeah, it's a father-son collaboration. It is a brand new book. It is 700 pages long. I just finished it this week, and it was very interesting. So we're going to be doing a couple of book chats about that. So that was the news I pulled from New York Comic Con, but I'm happy to have you back, Matthew, because, you know, this is where we want to be, right here in these chairs on a Thursday afternoon recording our show, and we want to talk about comics. So we are going to talk about comics, and if I had thought ahead, I would have already turned on my tablet to talk about the first comic that I have. Oh, I do have it on. Okay. The first comic that I'm going to talk about today is what I like about this. It's called Eugenic, and it is from Boom, but it is from James Tynion IV. And if you remember, there was a couple of other series that he did. One was called, was it Pneumonic? I think it was. But this is the third series in what he is calling his Apocalypse Trilogy. And so they're all sort of unrelated. But the Apocalypse Trilogy is a term that is often used to describe John Carpenter's movies, which are The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and In the Mouth of Madness. That is considered to be his Apocalypse Trilogy. And so it was cool that this is sort of the third story that James Tynion IV has done for Boom that is sort of kind of his end of the world sort of stuff. And it is him writing it. It is Eric Donovan who is doing the artwork, colors by Dee Kniff, and letters by Jim Campbell. And the editor on this book, the editors are Jasmine Amiri and Eric Harburn. And so the book starts with this. I'll just read you this little recap. It says, on December 6th, 2022 AD, it's not that far from now, a young woman checked into a hospital in Holmes County, Mississippi with a sharp, painful cough. 1 year later, there were 5 million dead in the American South alone, with another 2 million dead abroad. the Mississippi Delta virus, also known as the red cough or the pox, would take the lives of more than 700 million people over the next decade at peak. The United States Center for Disease Control would estimate that 60% of the world population was infected, either as a carrier or a victim. Then a little while later, it says in 2035 AD, pharmaceutical giant Corning Cole announced the mass production of a vaccine with a 100% success rate. United Nations would facilitate the free distribution of this vaccine in every country on the planet. The vaccine was developed by Dr. Cyrus Crane, a 33-year-old geneticist from Madison, Wisconsin. And that's where the book starts, is that the world has suffered this plague. There was a cure to it that was put out in 2035. And 2 years later, we pick up the story. And you have this doctor, Cyrus Crane, who was the creator of this cure, who is sitting there in front of a bank of monitors, and he is looking at what looks like children in the womb on monitors. And someone comes in and says, I should have known you would have been in here. And he's like, oh, they're sleeping. You know, what he's monitoring is that these are the first children that are going to be born post-vaccine. And so this is a big moment for the world in that, you know, this plague was thought to basically take out the rest of humanity. And now, because of the vaccine that this guy created, they are going to basically save humanity. And so then he's sort of ushered into a room where he's doing an interview, and they start asking, you know, he says, I'm Dr. Cyrus Crane, chief epidemiologist at Corning Cole. They say, you know, we can edit this interview if we need to, but they basically go over and say, you know, in the past few months, you've won a Nobel Prize and you've won the Presidential Medal of Honor. And from all reports, you most single-handedly developed this vaccine. You didn't even let your superiors know you were getting close to it for the better part of 2 years. And what's interesting about that is you kind of get a glimpse of the first thing that's going wrong here. Here was this guy who was a scientist that was working on this vaccine that could cure this plague that was affecting the world, and he wasn't letting anyone see what he was doing. So that's kind of red flag number one. And he's like, well, you know, I just didn't want to get people excited if I wasn't sure that it was going to happen or something like that, you know. And so then they talk about the fact that when the cure first came out, people were fighting over it and everything because they want to call this guy a hero. And he's kind of saying, oh, I'm not really a hero. You know, we couldn't get it out to people fast enough. There were riots. There were people who couldn't get the cure and stuff like that. So, you know, people turned on each other after this plague first came about. There was people who were infected versus the people who were not infected, and things got really ugly. And he's hoping that with the fact that there are new births, he says, it's been almost 9 months since the first large-scale vaccines were distributed. In the next few weeks, there will be the biggest influx of new births in 15 years. New births mean new possibilities and new hope. So what he's basically saying is that as these children are being born, this is sort of our chance to start over. This is our chance to be better than we were before because things got real bad there for a little while. And so now we flash to a woman who is having the first birth post-vaccine. And when the child comes out, the child looks very different than what they had expected. And so basically, it's hard to describe without the artwork, but essentially, the child's mouth is where their forehead should be. And they have, but otherwise, they're perfectly healthy. And so all of a sudden, all the people who have had this vaccine start having children that are all healthy, but have some sort of genetic anomaly or something like that. And this starts to happen more frequently with all the births that happen. And so you have this scientist who is now going to present in front of the pharmaceutical company that he is the main, you know, doctor for. And he's going there and people are saying, look, you know, we got to get in front of this thing because now people are freaking out that maybe the vaccine is causing some sort of a birth defect. And so we have to kind of figure out what's going on, and we have to get in front of this as a company because we don't want people to attribute the vaccine with being dangerous for children. And so he gets in front of all these people that work at this company and all the board members and all everything else. And he gets up there and you have like the CEO who says, you know, I wish I was standing here with a champagne bottle because the vaccine was perfect and all these kids were doing great. He says, but you know, I'm here because we made this choice. We developed this vaccine and now people are freaking out. But I'm here because Dr. Crane is telling me that there is no link between the side effects from that we're seeing in these childbirths and what happened with the vaccine. And so the doctor gets up and he's like, well, you know, I didn't exactly say that. I said there were no unintended side effects, but what's happening here is purely intentional. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? And then he basically goes on to explain that, you know, when I discovered that I was close to this cure and I discovered that I could basically rewrite people's DNA, I realized that the way that we are as a society, where everything is based on appearance and everything is based on if you're different than someone else, then, you know, they don't like you and all this kind of stuff. He said, I realized I could fix that. So I could basically change all of that. I could make it so that, you know, the traits that would make this generation smarter, happier, more creative, I could make sure that everybody had those, but I could make us better in that we'll never worry about appearance again and we'll never worry about, you know, that we look different than the next person because everybody's going to look different now. Everybody's going to look different than one another. There's going to be no defining physical trait. And so we'll be able to get past that. And of course, once he says that, everybody's like, what the heck did you do? And so, you know, security's coming, everything else. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the room starts getting sick. And he's like, I had a necrotic virus put into the air before we started this meeting today. So everybody in here is going to die because I don't want anybody stopping what I've already started because this has now started in the world and we're going to continue on with that. And so you have all the people in the room basically start melting, including this Dr. Cyrus Crane. And so that means that they're not going to stop passing out the vaccine and they're not going to get the word out or anything else. And now as we go into the next issue, because that's the end of the first issue, they're going to jump ahead in time and show you what the world has now become after this particular moment in time where this guy basically decided that the best way to ensure that the future is one without prejudice and without xenophobia and stuff like that is just to change everything we know and think about what is beautiful and what is, you know, that kind of stuff. And so at the end of the book, you get sort of a breakdown from the creative team about the design of the characters in this book, sort of what they were trying to accomplish with the design of Cyrus Crane, and then, you know, what we're going to sort of see in future issues. So I really, really enjoyed this first issue. And, you know, again, another book from Boom where they are breaking from the status quo of what you'd expect from a book. And James Tynion, I hope that when this particular series ends, he collects all three parts of his Apocalypse trilogy in one collected edition, because I think that would be a really cool hardcover to have. But yeah, great sci-fi slash horror story that is interesting in that it's really kind of following a timeline, and now we're going to jump ahead for the next one.
A little terrifying, because a lot of what you were talking about, it's not that far-fetched.
Well, I mean, you remember the movie Outbreak and stuff like that? I mean, there's always this idea of, like, you know, we're eventually – A, there's the idea that there could be a plague that affects the world that in modern times now that really, you know, destroys the population of the world.
Yep.
But there's also a lot of, you know, science fiction about we're not that far away from a point where we can really start to dial into the specific traits that people get. I mean, a lot of that work is already going on now. So, yeah, it is kind of scary when you put those two things together and say, well, what if one person came up with something that had that kind of effect and could do something on that big of a scale.
When you think about War of the Worlds, what was it that killed the Martians that came?
It was
germs.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I always used to be terrified of that. So all of a sudden, you know, when I'm in my 20s and 30s and everybody's talking about germ warfare, it's, oh, this isn't good.
Right.
But what is good, or I should say what was very interesting and a very good read, is Marvel Legacy number one. This is a book that when it came out a few weeks ago, I did not get it because I honestly had no desire to read it. There is nothing in there for me to get excited about. And then when I wanted to read it, I went back to the store and our local store was out of them. So while I was in New York, there was a couple of guys.
I was going to say, there must have been 1,000 copies of that thing.
So I went by a table as I ran to the bathroom, one of my trips, And they had all the Marvel Legacy books there, all different covers. I picked up the lenticular cover. Now, the cover price on it is $5.99. All the cover prices were $5.99. You get a pretty thick book, but the guy was selling them for $5 each. So I grabbed one of these. I also ended up picking Spirits of Vengeance number one up.
Oh, I wanted to get that. That's the one I'm really excited about.
And I got it with a lenticular cover. Now, what Marvel's doing with those covers is that you first look at it, and it's like giant size X-Men number one, and then you shift it over a little bit, and it is Spirit of Vengeance number one with just different characters coming out of that action pose.
That's cool.
So, yeah, they've done a great job with some of those. I was a sucker for that cover. I thought I picked another one up, too. But yeah, that's a book that I was really kind of interested in. I never read the first one, but I want to like Ghost Rider, and I like the whole idea of basically a team that was created in hell.
Right.
I think that's kind of got some good ideas to it. So the writer on this one, Jason Aaron, artist Asad Ribic with Steve McNiven. So and Matthew Wilson's a colorist. So to kind of give you what's going on in this book, let me give you all the artists that are in here. You got Chris Samnee, Russell Dodderman, Alex Malev, Ed McGuinness, Stuart Immonen, and Wayne Von Graubager, Pepe LaRose, Jim Chung, Daniel Acuna, Greg Land, and Jay Leinstein, Mike Diodato Jr., David Marquez, letters by Corey Pettit. So what this is, obviously, is sort of the primer for what is going to happen and what is going to be going on in the new Marvel Universe. And you are getting 10 to 12 little snippets of every book that's coming out from Marvel.
Oh, okay.
Sort of attached to a loose story going on. Now, the story starts out of 1 million years ago. And I also read this issue in a 5-star hotel, Brian.
Did it make it feel like it was even more epic?
It really did.
Yeah.
It really, really did, especially since I wasn't paying for this room. This was a hotel that had – it was the Kimberly was the name of it, and it had a doorman for the spinner door and a doorman for the luggage door. So that's kind of the classy place you had there. So we start out 1 million years ago BC with Thor's hammer just sitting there in a barren wasteland. And you've got somebody coming up, and they're cavemen, and they're talking all cavemenish, and they're trying to pick up the hammer, and it isn't working. So as they are trying, you see Odin's son, who is younger at this time, because he's not gray, and he's got both eyes, and he's got the helmet on. And he comes over, and he's talking about how he needs the hammer, and he keeps losing it, but here it is. And somebody is talking to him off camera, and it is the Phoenix. So they're all kind of dressed they're sort of wearing caveman-esque outfits, but with Odin's son wearing – or Odin being sort of like an old Viking, wearing just typical old Viking wear. So the two of them are talking, and he's talking about the fact that there was a time when he used to be able to pick it up with no problem. Nowadays, he can't do it. So you see that it takes some effort for him to pick it up, and he says, you know, I'm still trying to play along with these things, and I don't know what's going on. And you turn around, and you have the Hulk there, a version of the Black Panther, and a couple other Marvel characters that are looking down, and they see that a woolly mammoth is there, and it has been basically just destroyed. And you see somebody over there, and I'm not sure exactly who it is, talking about the fact that they took this from me. They took it for vengeance. So this was somebody's pet. Now you look over and you see a huge Iron Man type statue getting up kind of in the kind of the landscape of the million years BC kind of thing.
Yep.
And my first thought was that, oh boy, it's a Eternal that has shown up. Because the Eternals were the giants that ruled the earth way back then.
Celestials, right?
Celestials, yep. And they're talking about the fact that it also has the spirit of vengeance in it. And it also has it also can be quelched by the Sorcerer Supreme. So you've got Marvel characters in this time period that are talking about things that we all know about. And when you turn the page, you see that they start to attack it. And what is really cool is that the robot, the one they start attacking, has like Kirby-esque little art in it. So you can see a lot of the homage to that there. Now, before the battle starts, you go to now. And you've got a guy that is sleeping in a car. And a cop is in there saying, hey, you got to just keep going. You got to get going, move out of here. And he's like, I'm not getting out of the car. And he goes, all right. The cop says, now you need to get out of the car. So as this is going on, now this, I believe, is somebody that is from the Spirits of Vengeance series. I don't know exactly who he is. But the cop is like trying to open the door to pull him out of the car. He slams on the gas, starts speeding away. He's being chased by the cops. And he's like, I can't believe this is going on. Where the hell am I? And then all of a sudden, there's an explosion. And he ends up in a town called Cape Town. Now, Cape Town, I believe, is in Africa or South Africa. And he is now going, how did I get here? I don't know what is going on. And you've got a guy that shows up. His hands are glowing. He has sort of a logo on his chest. I don't, again, know who he is. But I believe that, again, he's part of this whole...
Is he Damien Hellstrom?
It might be, because he's got this... I'll show you, Brian, really quick. He's got a logo that I don't recognize.
I think that... Although that kind of looks like the Quasar logo, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's where I thought it was like Quasar, but I don't think it is. And then as he's trying to pull this guy out of the car now...
I'm just going to interject here. It doesn't sound like the book does that great a point of telling you who these characters are.
They don't. And one of the things...
Which is kind
of
crappy.
So one of the things, but I'll say in its defense, one of the things I liked was it made me at least interested enough to find out more about these guys. And as those two are ready to start fighting, all of a sudden they get knocked over by a car. The car gets thrown at one of them, and it is Ghost Rider. And Ghost Rider is basically saying, yeah, you guys need to fix this one right now. Then we go back to the realm of giants, Jotunheim. And you see Loki is leading a charge of some soldiers to go in. And they are going to fight the ice giants.
Yep.
Is who they were going to go fight. Now, as Loki is starting to get
That's like the Washington Generals of the...
Yes, yes. They just never have a chance. It looks good for the first couple four periods, but then it falls apart. So Loki is getting them into a tunnel, and then all of a sudden the tunnel disappears, and then Loki's kind of like, yeah, that's how I get rid of those guys. So we kind of fix these guys to do that. Now, back at a S.H.I.E.L.D. storage facility, you've got something that is in a crate. S.H.I.E.L.D. is all but broken up. And you've got the government is in there trying to get everything. Now, these ice warriors show up and start wiping out people. Thor's hammer gets thrown. And now you're getting your first look at the current Avengers lineup. So you've got Falcon, Thor. Who else is in there? You've got Iron Man. But is it Braveheart or whoever? Ironheart. So you've got the classic Avengers, but they're now the new modern version of them. Sort of what we saw in the last batch. And one of the ice giants has got somebody by the throat. He's going to kill him. They jump in. They save the day on that one. Now, this is where there's like three pages in here that were worth the price of admission. And one of them is this one right here, drawn by Chris Samnee. So need I even say who the character is going to be?
It's going to be Cap.
This is Captain America. So Captain America is sitting in a diner. Now, the last part of that battle, as they're fighting, they're talking about the fact that, you know what? This would be an easier battle to fight if we had a certain person with us in the Avengers. Then you turn the page over and it says, where's Captain America? You see he's sitting at a diner and he's watching the news and seeing about the recent takeover of Hydra of the country and all the things that happened afterwards. Things are going on really weird and we want to know what's going on. And where is the real Steve Rogers, by the way? So Steve is there. You got this waitress who was just completely smitten by him. And she's like, oh, you want another coffee? He's like, yeah, I'd love another good cup. It's a great idea. And she starts talking. She's like, where are you headed, handsome? And he's like, well, I wish I knew, ma'am. And the cool thing that was a very nice homage to Jack Kirby is he's still watching the news and he says, do you mind turning off the TV? You see the backpack with the shield sticking out of it. Because that was always like the cool thing. Like Jack Kirby used to draw Cap wearing a civilian skivvies with a shield on the inside behind underneath his clothes.
Uh-huh.
There's no way that could have happened because you'd have a shield print on it. So now you go in, you go to Asgardia, home of the gods. There's all this stuff going on right here. There's a few pages of Stark facility, what's going on. We constantly go back and forth to the battle with who is going to end up being the Spirits of Vengeance. A great moment where you're getting your first taste of Deadpool in the new world. And Deadpool, if you were worried at all that he was going to change, he's sitting on the crapper just with his hands on his head, looking down, kind of reflecting on all the things that are going on with three cops out there. And the cops are saying, if you don't come out right now, we're going to shoot. And then they're like, all right, time's up. And then you see him just sitting there as bullets are flying through the door, hitting him while he's on the toilet. Perfect, perfect Deadpool. The next page, you get kind of a couple things that made me get a little crazy about this one. So I am not a big Iron Fist fan. I am not a big Doctor Strange fan. I've never been a big Strange fan at all. But they're in the sanctum, and they're the two of them are talking about some things that are going on and what's happening. And all of a sudden, as they're having their conversation with each other, you see on the outside, Norman Osborn is walking away, mumbling about how, I'll take care of these two. I'll take care of this problem.
We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Holy crap. That got me a little excited. Then we go to Avengers Mansion, where you see Jarvis is looking out in the courtyard with a statue of the Avengers, talking about the fact how he wishes he could really put together another team. You have a battle of the ice giants and what's going on with some ice giants that are trapped on Earth. But, Brian, a thing for you that I really got excited for, there's two things that really got me excited, more for you than for me, but then it got me excited too. You've got two people talking on the top of a building, and they're saying, so much going on, you think they even remember us. And you've got, you turn down and you see Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm standing on the side of a building, and they're like, you know, I mean, we could get the whole team back together, or we could join that team and just be a team of Thors and Hulks and all that stuff. And he's like, yeah, spoken like a true moron. We need to get this going, and we need to do this. By the way, I don't care if people don't remember us or not. And you see him shoot the flare, and it says the four lit up in the sky.
Huh.
So very interesting. I thought, okay.
I wonder if it's just going to be them two, and I haven't followed the news coming out of that, but I wonder if it's just going to be them two palling around for a little while.
That's going to be Marvel 2-in-1.
Yeah, so I want to say that that may be those two teaming up with other people each issue.
So I knew about that book. I thought the same thing. I started to think, well, you know what? Two's better than nothing.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's
I love the thing, and I'm a fan of Human Torch as well. So it's great to have them back together. It's just – it's frustrating that – well, you know what? We'll see how it develops, but it's certainly frustrating to me that you're talking about Marvel legacy. You're talking about the getting back to the core superheroes that make the Marvel universe great, and you don't have the Fantastic Four.
So this is the last part of the book that got me very excited. Okay. So I skipped through about six or seven things with the Avengers, Wolverine coming back. I know more people are excited about that. I was like, just, yeah, that's great. He's back. But on the last few pages, there is a cosmic look, some crazy colors. And it says, what do we do? I suppose that what we do is kind of what we always have done. What has become our legacy? We stand on the shoulders of super geniuses and space gods, close our eyes and imagine a better, brighter, more amazing tomorrow, then bring it to life. And then you see that this life is starting to grow and grow. And there's a hand there looking, kind of comparing it to almost what looks like a hand in outer space growing. Something grand and fun and most staggeringly ridiculous. Something full of hope and compassion. Something both real and profoundly unreal. Something more and something magical. Something fantastic, and then all of a sudden you get it interrupted, and the voice off camera says, hey, what are you doing? And you turn the page, and it is Ben, it's Franklin and Valerie. Valeria and Franklin Richards. And she's like, oh, nothing, just mind your own business. And you see the two of them, and what is going on is they are headed back to Earth. And as the two of them have their little their banter back and forth. Now, Franklin has created pockets of universes in his own. Valeria has never really shown that much power, but there obviously is going to be a power there. But the last part of it was when she says, my name is Valerie Richards, and I'm closing my eyes now. I'm imagining my way home, and I'll see you when I get there. And then the last part of it has the four logo.
All right.
So I'm wondering that and hoping that this is going to be the book that is going to
come
out.
That's how they could bring me back.
A little bit later. I thought that, you know what, we got Ben and Johnny. This is a super cool way to bring them back.
Ben and Johnny's a great start. And, you know, for me right now, the Marvel universe is the Spidey books.
Yep.
And Ms. Marvel.
Yep.
And that's basically it. So Fantastic Four would certainly get me back and interested in that. But we're going to talk about Spider-Man because you mentioned Norman Osborn.
Yes.
So let's stay with the Norman Osborn for a second. If you have been reading Amazing Spider-Man, and we're going to talk about issue number 32 today, then you know that recently Norman Osborn made a return. Spider-Man ended up defeating him. There was Silver Sable showed up in the storyline that Norman came back in. And so Green Goblin is back on the scene. But what happened was that a while back, Peter had injected Norman Osborn with these nanites that basically would take the Goblin formula and it would get it out of his system no matter how many times he tried to put it in. So he can't turn into the Green Goblin anymore, and he has been trying to figure out a way to come back as the Green Goblin, and he hasn't been able to do it. And as the book opens, and when you saw him in the most recent Spider-Man storyline, like, he's had plastic surgeries, his face is all messed up and everything, and he's sitting in front of a computer, and he's injecting himself again with the Goblin Serum. And he's like, a Goblin Serum trial's final entry. I've increased the formula to the potency to its uppermost limit. It could kill thousands if it was weaponized. I need it to kill billions of the microscopic nanites Spider-Man put into my system. So he's thinking, if I give myself like a gigantic dose of this, it'll override whatever nanites he's put in my system, and it will activate and it'll bring back the Green Goblin. He does it. He's waiting. He's looking at his watch. Nothing happens. And so he's freaking out. He's saying, I can't go on like this. I need you. And he's speaking to the Goblin voice that used to be in his head. And he's like, I have to figure out, there has to be a way to fight what he's done to me. And you see him at the doctor's, and the doctor's saying, sorry, Norman, the nanites are replicating faster than I can destroy them. So they can't just destroy them. He's going to someone giving him hypnosis. And he's like, normally, you know, if there's a dormant persona, hypnosis could unlock that. But I'm afraid your will is too strong for this to work. I can't hypnotize you because you're too strong-willed. Then he goes to get acupuncture, and that doesn't work either. And so he's racking his brain. And when he went to get acupuncture, the woman says to him, perhaps what you need is something a little more unconventional. I've heard of a place, but I must warn you, it's not easy to get to. And you see him climbing through the mountains, and he ends up at the temple with no name, which is where Doctor Strange trained. So he ends there, and the three masters, Master Hawk, Master Ox, and Master Snake, meet him there. And they're standing there, and they're saying, you know, the fact that you've reached here speaks about that you have an indomitable will. What you can see, that you can see us, speaks to the strength of your spirit, and that you would even attempt such a journey speaks to of great need. Tell a stranger, what is it that you are facing? And he says, can you help me? Can you fix me? Can you heal me? And they say, he says, I'm not worried about my face, because they're like, oh, is it your face that you're talking about? No, not my physical appearance. Who I am on the inside needs to be restored. And they're like, oh, well, that's the correct answer. Come with us. And so they take him to a temple, and he gets inside this place, and they say, behold, it's the Emerald Oracle of Icon. And he's like, what am I supposed to do? And they say, well, put your hand on it. This is your first test. You know, and so he goes up and he puts his hand on this thing. And when he does, all of a sudden, this magical energy comes out of it. And he says, I assume this is satisfactory to you guys. And they're like, it's astounding. You know, we'll begin your training immediately. And you can see that he's excited about that. And so the next thing you see is basically Norman Osborn studying all the books at the Temple of No Names, you know, practicing in the ways of martial arts. He's meditating all the time. He is having conversations with the masters. And, you know, he's saying, you know, there are stories, tales of men I've heard that you guys have trained here. And they're like Mordo, Strange, Von Doom, you know, and they're talking about all that stuff. And you just see him doing these physical trials where, like, he's walking downstairs, but, like, basically doing push-ups and stuff like that. Like, he's completely, you know, recreating his own body, but also practicing the mystical arts. And so, you know, he says to one of the masters one day, your names, Ox, Hawk, Snake, are they ranks? Are they titles? How did you earn them? And they're saying every man has a guide, a totem, which links them to this world. You know, there will come a day when your totem will make itself known. It will find you and choose you. And then that will sort of be your path. And so one day he's out meditating and a tiger comes up to him. And he looks right in the face of the tiger, and he says to then later one of the masters, I've had my vision. And they're like, great, well, we'll go into the temple. And he walks into the temple, and there's all these masks on the wall. And they're like, it's time, you know, take your totem. This is the final test. And he walks right over to the tiger totem, And he looks at it, and they're saying, reach out, accept your destiny. And he says, no, I accept nothing. I choose my own destiny. And he chooses a mask that looks like the goblin. Mm. And he puts that on, and he basically says, and I decide which demons I have to face. And then he conjures up Spider-Man. And Spider-Man shows up, and he's like, with extra chocolate. And he was ordering a sundae. And he turns around, and he's like, what? You're not Mr. Softy. And so the two of them end up fighting, and Norman uses his mystical powers to basically beat Spider-Man. And when he does that, he's about to go in for the killing blow, and the Masters dismiss Spider-Man, and they send him back to where he came from. And he's like, you didn't let me kill him. Why didn't you let me do that? And they're like, well, you defeated him, so you've proven that you're better, and you're all done here. And he's like, no, he's just going to keep coming back. I have to kill him and everything. And he's getting ready to now battle the Masters, because he's like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I'm more powerful than you now. You can't stop me. And they're like, you're turning into a monster. And so he goes to fight them. And as the room fills with mystical energy, everything goes back to the moment that he put his hand on that gem, because all of that just took place in his head and in the heads of all of the Masters. So they saw, basically, this is what would have happened if we trained you. This is what you would have become. And so he says, what was that? And he turns around and one of them says, that's the first test, your only test. You're done here. And they basically kick him out. And he's like, I could have been, you know, I could have had this power. And as they banish him and he's kind of wandering around the mountains, he realizes that, yeah, I failed that test. But what I figured out is I can become the Green Goblin again. It is still inside of me, and I can become that, and they'll never get rid of that, and I'm going to find a way. And that's the way the issue ends. And then it says, under Marvel Legacy, the next thing that happens is, it says, Peter Parker, threat or menace. So it looks like Pete is back in New York, and things are going to start going the old Parker way again.
Oh, perfect.
But the cool thing about that was that this was all about Norman. This was all about his quest to become the Green Goblin again, and just showed you like what he would have done with that power. Like, he's never changing from who he is. This is who he is, and this is who he's always going to be. And it was really, really cool. So your creative team on that one, Dan Slott, was writing it. Greg Smallwood was the artist. Jordi Belair on colors. And let me tell you, the colors are amazing. Joe Caramagna lettering. And then, of course, Alex Ross on covers. And Nick Lowe is the editor on that one. So very, very good issue. And I'm really, really liking where this book has been lately. And even though I'm not super excited to have Norman come back and be like the big cheese again, I want him back in Spidey lore. I just don't want him to be thought of as like the Joker to Batman.
The Lex Luthor of Superman.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because like, and I know a lot of people believe that he will always be that, but for me, Dan Slott has made Dr. Octopus that now. He has become Spider-Man's greatest enemy. And so for me, like, I'm happy to see Norman back in the mix, but I think his time as Spider-Man's greatest foe should be over.
Mm.
Because I think Doc Ock has, with all the storylines that have gone through with Superior Spider-Man and everything else, to me, Doc Ock is now definitively the biggest Spider-Man enemy. And that's just my personal opinion. But in any case, happy to see Norman kicking back around. And it was good to see an issue kind of just focused on him. So
does the Legacy number start?
It starts
with
the next
issue?
One, I think. That's a good question. Does it say the number?
I would say it got to be in like the 600,
789. So this was sort of the capper of the Amazing Spider-Man sort of reboot numbering, and now it's going to go back to Legacy numbering. So there you go. That's your books for this week. But we can't wrap up this episode, Matthew, without getting into the boob tube and the big screen bonanza. Now, we both saw the Riverdale premiere, so we'll talk about that in a minute. You did not see the Flash season premiere this week, but I did see the Flash season premiere.
Yep.
And it was very interesting. I'm debating on how many spoilers to get into, but basically, as you know, at the end of last season, Barry had to basically go be imprisoned in the Speed Force, because without someone being imprisoned in the Speed Force would basically destroy all of reality.
Yes.
And so he left, and we pick up now 6 months later in this episode where Iris has taken kind of a lead role on Team Flash, and you have Vibe and Kid Flash, who are now the heroes that are the core of this team. And so Iris is the one who's kind of coordinating, almost like Harrison Wells used to do in the past. He was absent from this episode. Mm-hmm. because obviously HR.
HR is dead.
Died, and then the other Wells went back to his reality. And so there was no Wells in this episode. I hope that Wells comes back in some way, shape, or form in the future because I love Tom Cavanaugh. So not having him in this one was a bummer, but it was an action-packed episode. There was a samurai android that showed up in town and was threatening to destroy the city if he didn't get the Flash and stuff like that. That was kind of the backstory. But the main story was that you have Vibes, alternate personality. Why can't I remember his name?
Cisco.
Cisco. Thank you. Cisco has been working on a way to bring Barry back from the Speed Force. And Iris has gotten to a point where it's 6 months with Barry gone. She has now convinced herself that he is never coming back. And so she has tried to bury herself in the work and just kind of move on. And so you see that when Cisco starts talking about bringing Barry back, she is almost hesitant to even attempt that. And Cisco at one point is like, oh, you of all people should want us to bring him back. Because when Kid Flash goes up against this samurai, he fails.
Was it the Silver Samurai?
It wasn't.
Okay.
Which he's Marvel, right? Silver Samurai?
There's a samurai. I'm picturing a cover of a Flash comic, and I just don't remember. I thought it was a Silver Samurai, but you're right. That is Marvel.
I think they end up calling him Samuroid or something like that, but he's a samurai android is what he ends up basically being. But the whole thing was about the fact that they get Caitlin to come back on the team, even if it's just temporarily. She's been battling her Killer Frost tendencies. They introduce a couple new characters that you don't really know who they are yet, but they're definitely going to play a role in upcoming episodes. But the big thing was that they actually freed Barry from the Speed Force. But when they freed him, his mind was kind of all jumbled. He was writing in these strange symbols when he came back, and he was speaking in a way that he wasn't forming coherent thoughts or sentences and stuff like that. And what ended up jarring him out of that and bringing him back fully into his own head was the fact that Iris basically gave herself over to this android, knowing that if anything was going to get Barry to snap out of it, it was going to be the fact that she was in danger.
Yes.
And so he ends up at the, as you might imagine, snapping out of it at some point and going, and the two of them get reunited. And that was kind of the core of this particular episode. So, I mean, it was a fun episode. It was a lot of action in this episode. I thought it was a little bit, I'm sure there's going to be repercussions, and I hope there will be, of what happened to Barry while he was gone, because all the symbols that he came back drawing and just the after effects that he had when he was brought back, hopefully that has lasting effects throughout the season. Because if not, it was kind of a quick revamp of what happened at the end of last season, which I don't know if we talked about this on the show or not, but when he was imprisoned in the Speed Force, like, I didn't really like that.
No.
I didn't like that ending. Like, after all the stuff they went through with Savitar and everything, and after all that, for them to finally get a happy moment, and then
literally an hour later, oh my gosh, you know what I forgot to tell you?
By the way, the Speed Force is blowing up, and I need to go and be a prisoner in it forever. Like, that to me just felt really unearned as a story point, you know, like they hadn't done anything to really build up to that. And it was kind of just like, how can we leave the season on a cliffhanger sort of thing? So that kind of bothered me. And they bring him back, but I kind of also felt like I would be fine with Kid Flash and Cisco being the team for two or three episodes, maybe even four episodes, maybe the first part of the season where, and other shows have done that. Buffy did that. Arrow did that. Like, there's been other shows that have had multiple episode arcs where the main hero hasn't come back yet. And that's kind of an interesting thing to explore. And I wish they would have maybe spent a little bit more time exploring that. Now, maybe this isn't the real Barry that came back. Maybe something else is going to happen with this. But yeah, it was just interesting to see how that kind of played out. But it got the approval from my son.
Good.
We thought it was a great first episode of the season, and it definitely was plenty of action. So that worked out. That worked out good. So there was that on Tuesday night.
Yep.
And then last night we had the return of Riverdale.
And I didn't know that this was even coming because I just finished watching game four of the Nationals and the Cubs.
Yep.
Which ended in a grand slam with the Nationals, so we won.
Yep.
So I was very happy. Then I'm flipping over and I'm looking over going, oh, I can watch the Goldbergs. And my wife pointed out that Riverdale was on. So I thought, oh, we better watch Riverdale. And if you were looking for an episode that was going to be lighthearted, fun, have some quirky moments to it, not a lot of seriousness, this is the absolute opposite of that one. Because from the second you start to the last scene, your emotions are all over the place.
Right.
And I told my wife and my daughter Becky was hanging out with us. I said, if this was not with Archie characters, this show would be the most stupid show I've ever seen in my entire life. But because it's part of characters I grew up with, part of people I love and care about, I was sucked right into it. And you start out where the season ended last year with Fred Andrews being shot at Pop Tate's.
Yep.
And Archie, and Jughead is the narrative of the whole thing, telling the story like he would if it was a news story. And you see Archie, he has him in the truck, and he's driving all the way, hitting cars, driving off the street.
I thought they did such a good job with that. And just to go back to what you said a second ago, like I think that from a story standpoint, that first episode of The Flash this week was very straightforward.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't a ton of layers to it. Whereas what I thought about this Riverdale episode is that there's so many storylines that are packed into this first episode, like stuff that is picking up plot threads from last season, yep. but also introducing plot threads from this season. Like it reminded me of the first season of The Flash. Remember when the first season of The Flash, we used to say, it feels like every episode is the season finale.
Yes.
That's how Riverdale opened this week.
And it was a lot like Twin Peaks. This was more Twin Peaks than last season, and we thought that was very Twin Peaks.
Right, it's getting even weirder in this season, yep. which I really like. Like, they're doubling down on the sort of the sort of twisted nature of what's behind this idyllic little town.
Yeah.
And that is very Twin Peaks.
And it gets worse. I mean, the whole thing that is probably the main story, and there's some very emotional things in there.
Super powerful moments. Like the whole thing with, first of all, just Archie barely holding it together, but doing what he needs to do to get his dad to the hospital.
Yeah.
Very powerful, you know, scene. And, you know, it actually brought back some memories for me of when I was in college and my father had a heart attack and I basically drove him to the hospital.
Oof.
And it brought back that kind of moment for me because that was super powerful of where he, you know, and if it wasn't for him, that his dad wouldn't have made it.
Yeah.
You know? And so you had that going on, and then you had the repercussions with Betty and Jughead of the serpents.
Yes.
You
of know? Him putting on the jacket.
Exactly.
Because his dad is now in jail. So he is now living in a trailer on his own. However, he's now been put in a foster family on the South Side. But the South Side family said, you know what? We'll pretend you live here. You can go live at your other place.
Yep.
So you've got a lot of that stuff going on. And that's really kind of you just see Betty and Jughead's relationship getting better. I think one of the most – going to get all choked up. Wicked, powerful, emotional scenes – was when they walked in, Betty and Jughead walked into Pop Tate's.
Yeah.
And he's in there just cleaning up the blood.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I'm sorry, we're close. Hey, kid. And he started talking with them. And then they're getting ready to leave and just snapped. He goes, hey, you kids hungry?
Yeah.
And it broke my heart because you think about horrible things that happen and there has to be some bit of semblance of sanity, something to hold on to.
Right.
And you just saw that Pop Tate just had a horrible thing happen in front of him. And he's just trying to grab onto the first thing that's real, and that is making sure these kids are happy.
Yep. That was super powerful. The moment where Archie kind of was trying to get Veronica to leave him alone.
Yeah.
And she didn't leave, and he just completely broke down in front of her. Like, that was super powerful. Like,
all the dreams
that Fred was having. Yeah, which I guess, like, that to me was, like, kind of what I expected out of this episode. Whenever you have a character who's kind of life hangs in the balance, you often have those whole, at death's door dream state sort of things where they're reliving pieces of their life and their stuff like that. So I kind of expected that to happen, but it was the other moments around it to me that were really, really powerful. And that would have been, like, enough. Right? That would have been enough for the storylines. But then you got Cheryl and her mother.
I was waiting for that one because...
So Cheryl's basically become like the villain.
The creep factor went up 1,000
uh-huh.
when she walked in. And in the last episode, because Cheryl was so distraught. And you know, you feel bad because Cheryl was legitimately hurt and upset and destroyed that her brother died. And to find out that her father did it,
right,
to find out that her mother knew about it, that there were all these things that they were hiding, the things about Jason and Polly, all the things that were hidden. So Cheryl in the last episode decided, you know what, I'm going to burn everything down. I'm going to burn the memories down. She burned the house down and her mother got trapped inside.
Yep.
After those two were fighting. So Cheryl was kind of responsible for her mother getting all burned up, which we see smoke inhalation, really not doing too well. And there's a moment when Cheryl walks in, she tells everybody, my mommy saved my life. She came in from the burning building. And everybody's like, oh, wow, that's great. Door closes and she holds the oxygen hose,
right,
and says, this is the way it's going to be. I told everybody that you saved my life and that's the way it's going to be. The second that you do this, you're going to be gone. And then the worst part, the creepiest part, was when she went in and she gave Fred Andrews a kiss on the forehead and said, you gave Archie, you gave me the kiss of life and brought me back. I'm doing the same for your father.
Yeah.
And then like an hour later, he's back. And it's like, this girl is completely creepy.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have the Hiram Lodge stuff, too.
Oh, Hiram's. Yeah.
So like tons of stuff happened in this first episode that kind of lays out a lot of, you know, storylines for this particular season of the show. So it's not like, what I liked about it is it wasn't like they were like, they rested on the laurels of the last season. They came out this season swinging and I liked that. So I would say if you enjoyed last season of Riverdale, you can't help but be blown away by the season premiere of this one.
There was no drop off at all.
No.
In fact, I think that it even picked up a lot more than I thought it would.
Right.
Having Hiram in there, you know that you now have five or six different factions that could have been responsible for Fred being shot.
Sure.
I mean, everybody's guilty right now. So
and then the green-eyed, you know.
Yes.
And then, of course, Miss Grundy.
So my thought on that one, because we see Miss Grundy at the end with yet another young kid that she sucked in with music lessons. And at the end, she gets picked up by the neck and hacked and killed. And it's by the same guy that shot Archie's dad. So if you remember in the very first couple episodes with her, whether or not it was a lie or not, she always talked about her ex-husband.
Yeah.
So it could be that too. You know, hey, you took my girl, Archie. I'm going to take your dad.
Right.
Could have been Hiram. Could have been like one of the – like they. You saw the snakes, the Southside Serpents, got a guy, beat the hell out of him in Jughead's apartment or in his trailer. When Jughead walked in, he's like, what is going on? Yeah, this guy was mouthing off how we did it. We beat him up and we realized it's not him. And I think it might have been one of – it probably was the main guy in the Serpents that we talk about, because you've never gotten a clear shot at this eye color. So now every time you meet somebody new, you're looking for the eye color. So they've done a great job with a lot of that stuff to make you interested in every single character and every secondary person that walks on set. First thing you're going to do is look at their eye color.
Yeah, and the whole thing with like the way they light certain scenes and the visuals and stuff like that, it's just really well done. So, man, good start to the week. I think Arrow's on tonight as I think about it. Thursday is Arrow, and I haven't seen the Supergirl premiere yet either. But
Didn't watch that one yet.
Lots of good stuff. The shows are back. That is your boob tube for this week, and that is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week. Oh, one more thing, Matthew. I mentioned before that I thought that it was Stan Winston that developed the pumpkin head design. Not only was it his studio did that, but that was his directorial debut.
Oh, interesting.
He directed Pumpkinhead.
Nice.
There you go. That little fun fact at the end of the show there. So that's going to wrap up this episode. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.